particularly in oscilloscope, when you set the oscilloscope probes into high impedance mode so that they don't disturb the circuit. Over to you, John, KQIW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Because any time he goes in there with a voltmeter trying to measure that with resistors or whatever, he's going to disturb the response of that trap, from what I understand, and that's usually what happens to me. So I think your suggestion is, yeah, look at the input and the output and do the calculations. Whether you calculate it or actually measure it, it should be the same. So, very good. All right, that's it from the from the mailbag. And we'll go on to Paul and see what he's got for us. I'm sure he's got a lot of information on that that failure. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Before we leave you tonight, John, what did you see on Echolink, IRLP, chat room? What kind of activity did you see tonight, John? And is Rich out there, K2UPS, also out there monitoring us? Over to you, John.
No, I don't see K2UPS on the list in Echo. Let's see. We got between 9 and 11 there, and the chat room had absolutely no action at all tonight. But Echolink has been busy.
In the case of Echolink, what's the greatest DX that you've seen on that list tonight, John? Are there any foreign countries?
Just one from Canada. That's the only one outside of America.
Yeah, those guys in the Golden Horseshoe are, they keep their ear to the ground. Okay, Paul. I think it was called a... all of a sudden, I've forgotten the name of the darn thing. The Russian supply ship that I mentioned earlier. And I think it was called the MS-4 model number. Progress. Progress MS-4. And what is MS-4, if I remember it correctly, what does that stand for? WS2N with our space report. And here comes space report number 230. K2RIW, you've got a ball.
Is that an unscheduled rapid disassembly?
Yeah, it turns out the Progress spaceship got re-kitted. That's not a not-so-nice joke. Over to you, Paul.
This is WS2N. Put a space portion of the TechNet. It sure did. It went up with, 5,600 pounds of cargo. And it was supposed to go to the space station. It was going to get there in 2 days. They have a long way to go. They didn't update the ground, the Russian ground terminals yet to accommodate the new Progress spacecraft. This is about the fourth flight of this version. They've upgraded the Progress ships over the years. They used to launch these things as far back as Mir, and even before that, to one of the earliest Soviet space stations. So the Progress has been around a long time. So all these letters, translation from Russian words, which mean something, but not sure what they mean. But yet, this is the fourth version of this one. Now, supposedly, there's nothing wrong with the Russian Progress craft itself. It has to do with the separation between it and the third stage. They had a failure like this in, let's see, 2 Aprils ago. And it took them about 6 months to work that problem before they started flying again. And, of course, there's some concern because the Progress ships look and are designed very similar to the Soyuz manned spacecraft that go up to bring up 3 astronauts at a time. So there's always some concern with what the problem is. And yeah, they would have made a direct flight 6 hours to the space station like what they were doing with the old ones, but they still haven't got the ground support to match the new electronics for the new Progress updated. But what happened was they know that it did not separate from the third stage properly. And I think the thing probably separated and blew up at the same time. The third stage probably blew up, and the spacecraft wound up low orbit and deorbited in the forest over Russia somewhere. And they have some pictures of that coming down. Let me drop it. So there's a lot of things on there, really, for the Russian side. There's some stuff for the United States on there that's replaceable. And they did have a new all-in Russian spacesuit that was supposed to go up for the Russian side, but of course they're going to send a new one up, for EVAs. But mostly cargo, fuel. There was a lot of fuel on board. A couple hundred pounds worth of hydrazine to be pumped into, says the, the Russian module, so that the space station has more fuel for maneuvering. So that, of course, will have to be delayed until the next Progress goes up. As far as supplies and material, not to worry. We have another launch of a Japanese cargo ship that was scheduled anyway for the 9th, coming up this week. I think it's Friday. I think it was 8:30 or 8:26 officially in the morning. So you get to watch that go up from Japan on the NASA channel. Go to the NASA website and you can bring up their live feed of that. And that brings up a lot more stuff than Progress. That brings up around a little over 10,000 pounds of stuff, compared to roughly 5,500 pounds from Progress. So that will be taken care of shortly. And now it looks like SpaceX is getting their act together. They'll be flying on the 16th from California, from Vandenberg Air Force Base. They'll be bringing one spacecraft up that they wanted to, actually 10 spacecraft up that they wanted to bring up a while back. And they're the Iridium Next spacecraft. So apparently SpaceX believes they have straightened out their problem from last September 1st when their rocket blew up on the Launch Complex 40 in Florida, destroying its whole rocket. And the Amos 6 satellite that was being flown for Israel by an Israel company. So a couple of flights down the road, SpaceX has another cargo mission scheduled probably for the end of January, maybe beginning of February, to go to the International Space Station. So they're really not short on supplies or anything on the ISS. But Russia sure would like to straighten out these problems. They have problems going uphill with a lot of their rockets, but not only the Soyuz, but the Proton rocket, a couple of the other ones. They have a rocket actually called Rockot, and it's not spelled like rocket, but it's spelled a little differently. They get, 100 miles high, and they have problems. I think they've lost around 10 or 15 of their rockets in the last, 10, 15 years in that fashion. Otherwise, they do okay. Now, the Soyuz rocket, they consider that three stages. It's got four strap-on boosters, and those boosters are liquid and liquid oxygen. So they're liquid boosters. And they consider that the first stage. The center core is considered the second stage. So the four strap-on boosters separated properly after a couple of minutes, and then the second stage also separated. And between the second and third stage, the third stage, call it hot fire. It actually fires before the second stage drops off, and the exhaust actually helps push the second stage away. So I thought maybe that would be the problem, but it was flying a little bit after that. So what happened? What materialized after that? I don't know. It looks like it cut off early, and then. And then the spacecraft itself, Progress, separated. So, and then those will come out. I'll probably find out within a week or two. Let me drop it to WS2N. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Again, the six astronauts on board are safe. And I could attest that I know everything's going fine up there because I saw it go over tonight. I went out there and saw it around 4:54, I think it was, tonight. Right overhead, 86 degree altitude off the horizon. Not a cloud in the sky. It was beautiful. I got to watch it for a solid 6 minutes, and it popped up when it was supposed to. I could see it, and dive in, you know, into the south, into the northeast. So that was pretty cool. And we have two Americans on board, Peggy Whitson and Shane Kimbrough, and then four other people, a couple of Russians, one guy from Europe. That's always interesting to watch. We drop it.
I missed that poll. Tell me once again, right back to the wrong mic. What is it you watch tonight? Go ahead, go by your house. Go ahead.
Yeah, the International Space Station went directly over, right over Ronkonkoma. It was 86 degrees. I mean, as far as I was concerned, it was 90 degrees when it was at the peak. My head had to be straight up. Look at this thing, and it looked like it popped out right by the moon. See, it officially came over the horizon at 4:52. So if you had a radio, you know, you would be able to start transmitting at that time. You couldn't see it yet. As you know, when you see the space station go overhead, it's the reflection of the sun. So it was still in bright light at that point, but the prediction on the website was 4:54, and sure enough, exactly 4:54 in a couple of seconds, it magically appeared. It looked like it popped out from the right where the moon, you know. I was looking at the quarter of a moon that was up there. Venus was down to the right, down and right of the moon. And to the left of the moon, here comes the space station. So that's what I saw go overhead there. With no clouds in the sky, it was beautiful. Back to you.
Now, what direction were you looking when you first saw it? It sounds to me like you were looking to the southwest. It went almost straight overhead and went to your northeast, if I understand correctly. And as it went to your northeast, didn't it eventually get shadowed by the Earth and it suddenly blink out, is a guess on my part? Over to you, Paul.
I saw it probably down to around 15 or 20 degrees, and then at that point there's a lot of trees, so I lost it. Whether it blinked out after that, I don't know. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the trees cut it off, but I watched this for a solid 6 minutes from the second it lit up until I lost it without a cloud in the sky. And according to the website, it was -3.3 magnitude, so you know what that is, Dick. So that's very bright. The lower the numbers, the brighter it is.
When you first saw the International Space Station, I'm guessing you first saw it to something like the southwest. Was it an object that you suddenly started seeing, or did it suddenly blink on, so to speak? If it's coming from the southwest, it's in greater sunlight than we are. So I'm guessing you saw it continuously illuminated as it came over your southwest horizon. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
It was 40, I think 41 degrees above the horizon when I first saw it. And that was a prediction by two websites that I go to. One is an app and the other one is a NASA website. Well, anyway, around 41, let's call it 40 degrees above the horizon, it just came on and stayed on. The brightness really never changed from that point. All right, when it started going low on the horizon and to the northeast, it got a little dimmer, but not much. It was pretty bright. So, I picked it up from the south, from the southwest, directly overhead into the northeast. Well, a little bit more east than north, but there you go. Back to you there.
And they predicted you'd see it at 4:50, I think you said, or 4:54. And it was already 40 degrees above the horizon. Now, that confuses me because since it was high up and west of you and the sun is setting to the west, you would think it is more illuminated then. Therefore, it shouldn't suddenly pop on. I'm beginning to think that you just happened to catch your eye in the right direction at that time, but it didn't suddenly light up at a particular position. My guess is if you could have seen it first come over your southwest horizon, I'm guessing it would have been illuminated at that time. And by the way, did you pick this up on Heavens Above? Is that one of the sites up, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, I use the app for Heavens Above, and I also now use the NASA website. They have a link for that as well. But, it has to do with the time of day. It was still light out. So, the spaceship had to get into a dark area. So, the same amount of light was on it, but it was bright in the, the background was bright. So, the second it got into an area of darkness, that's when it looks like it lights up for us, That's when you first see it. And that was a prediction, and that's what happened. So, I know exactly where to look.
What was the relationship between the ISS and the moon when you first saw it, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, it looked like it fell out of the moon. I would say probably 10 degrees south. It would be southeast, 10, 15 degrees southeast of the moon. Venus is off to the much more further east, south. Further west, southwest. You saw Venus last night. It was right under the moon, so it's probably 15 degrees. I think it's 15 degrees a day. The moon moves. And Venus moves, but not that much as far as we're concerned. Probably about 15 degree difference from last night. So Venus is 15 degrees to the right of the moon, which means west, and then this thing was about 15 degrees. It would have made a good photograph to get all three together. That would have been cool.
Earlier tonight, Paul, you made it sound like there was a strong similarity between the booster that's used for Progress and the booster that's used for Soyuz that brings the astronauts up to the International Space Station. Now, in the days of Apollo and Mercury and Gemini, when they lifted off from the launch pad, there was an escape structure on the top of the capsule, a rocket that, in the event of a failure, would blast the escape capsule away from the rest of the vehicle. Does Soyuz have anything like that? If there was a problem with the booster and Soyuz, what is the fallback? What is the protection mechanism for the astronauts? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, well, of course, you look at the two rockets side by side, they look the same. But the big difference is the launch escape system on the Soyuz. They have the tractor type system, which means that as rockets mounted above the spacecraft, and if there's a problem, they would pull the spacecraft away from the booster. Of course, privates don't have that. We're not worried about people on that. That's just a cargo vehicle. And then they have little rockets at the top of the launch escape platform that launch anyway to pull the cover away from the spacecraft. So that's very similar to what we had with Apollo and with Mercury. And what we'll eventually have with Orion, they have a launch escape system too, a real big one. That's a monster being built by Orbital Science. Well, now it's Orbital ATK. They merged. So they main ones, and then future manned missions from Earth, from U.S. soil. You know, excluding the Orion, which I already pointed out, the two private companies, Sierra Nevada and SpaceX, let's talk about the Sierra Nevada later. That's the Dream Chaser. The two that are going to be going up will be by United Launch Alliance and SpaceX. SpaceX will have the Dragon, and United Launch Alliance will be launching the Boeing craft called Starliner. Now, Starliner and Dragon don't have the escape, the tractor type. It's not going to pull the rocket away. They're going to have pusher rockets mounted in the inside the spacecraft. Again, it's going to push from below if there's a problem. The Dragon uses these Super Draco engines. There's going to be 8 of them inside of the inside of their spacecraft to do that job. And Boeing has something similar. I believe they have four engines. But it make the completely different engines, but same idea. It's going to push the spacecraft away and drop it. Only other ones that we haven't talked about as far as escape systems was the shuttle and the Gemini spacecraft. Gemini spacecraft had ejection seats. They did not have any kind of an escape system as far as pulling or pushing. And of course, the space shuttle had ejection seats in the beginning. I believe it was the first four missions. After that, they did away with the ejection seats. They threw them away and sealed it up, and you just said a prayer and took off. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I guess it was one of the wrong mic. I guess it was one of the later sets of missions of the shuttle that no longer had the escape pod. As I remember, there was a pod where each of the astronauts stayed in their chair, and the whole pod, as a module, removed itself from the rest of the shuttle. And the later one, I guess they only did that on the first few. Now, you made it sound like there's more than enough supplies on board the International Space Station. The 5,600 pounds of supplies that was going to be brought up by the latest Progress, it's not creating a shortage, just that the amount of backup is not as great. The fuel, oxygen, food, maybe other supplies. And like you said, the new spacecraft, the new space suits for EVA for the Soviets, astronauts, cosmonauts, those got lost in this latest Progress failure. And the very next mission going up, I think you said, is Japan. I'm a little bit amazed by that. I didn't know that Japan is supplying... boosting for supplies to the International Space Station. That's a new one on me, Paul, because, wait a minute, I'm confused. J- China has its own space station. Japan does not. So is Japan supporting the United States effort? I must be very forgetful because I don't remember that one. WS2N, KQRIW.
I believe this is their sixth supply mission to the space station. They go up roughly once a year. And, you know, we're talking about Japan now. Japan launches from Takashiga launch complex from Japan. They have their own rocket. They have a smaller version of the rocket, the H-2A. And then they added another rocket to that, another engine to that. And they call it now the H-2B. Well, this thing is powerful enough to launch a good-sized cargo ship to the space station. And the cargo ship is called the HTV, or, you know, it stands for Transfer Vehicle. So, HTV will be launched on Friday. If you look at the NASA site at 8, I'm trying to remember, I think at 8:20, I'll start looking at probably quarter after 8, but roughly around 8:30 it goes off. You'll see their rocket go up from Japan. And they carry a little over, I think it's a little over 10,000 pounds, which is almost twice the amount that that the Progress was. Let me drop it. Has a similar berthing situation to what the Dragon does and what the Cygnus does by orbital ATK. They come up within around 30 feet of the space station, and then the American astronauts reach out with the 57-foot robotic arm that's attached to the space station, grab a hold of it, and they berth it into, I believe in this case it's going to be the Unity node. They'll bolt it into that, 16 bolts, and they have a big wide door to go in, and after unloading 10,000 pounds of stuff, they'll load it up with trash, and the HTV is one of these cargo vehicles that, when they disconnect from the space station, they burn up over the Pacific Ocean. So basically, we have four different, at this time, we have four going up, four different cargo vehicles. Let me drop it. The Progress, which is going to be grounded again for a while. The HTV, which is supposed to go up about 3 or 4 months ago. But that got grounded because it had a leak in the body of the thing when they did a vacuum test on it. So they had to disassemble a lot of stuff to fix that. Now it's fixed and ready to go up. And then we have Dragon, and that's been grounded since September 1st, since the explosion on the Launch Complex 40. And that should be going up probably within another month or two. They're going to start reflying from Vandenberg Air Force Base on the 16th of this month. And then the fourth one is the Cygnus spacecraft by Orbital ATK, which launches from Virginia, from a Wallops Island, Virginia. And that's the one we saw a couple of months ago up. And that successfully unloaded everything, and just last week or so they deorbited that. Let me drop it. Before that, all those four spacecraft were involved. There were two others that have since been canceled. One is a space shuttle that used to bring up everything, you know, that was just a flying truck. Well, that's gone. And the other one that's gone is the European Space Agency ATV, which they flew five missions up to the space station. And that used to bring up about three times the amount of cargo than the Progress ship. Progress, let's call it around 5,000, the HTV by Japan, about 10,000. And the ATV, automatic transfer vehicle by European Space Agency, was roughly 15,000 pounds of stuff. And that since has been canceled. they've lived up to their contract. But it turns out that ATV did so good as a standalone spacecraft, NASA decided to give them the job of making the service module based on the ATV, the automatic transit vehicle system, for the Orion spacecraft. So we're building the Orion spacecraft here. We're building the space launch system, the whole rocket and the tanks and all solid booster rockets here in the States. But the service module for the Orion spacecraft is really being copied off the canceled ATV cargo vehicles that used to go up to the space station. And then the last one I wanted to talk about, I started talking about before, was SNC, that's Sierra Nevada Corporation. They come out of Colorado. They'll be launching the Dream Chaser, and probably by 2019, I guess. Maybe the beginning of 2019. And that's roughly it. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2S.
Well, I wasn't aware that there's four vehicles bringing up supplies: Progress, HTV, Dragon, and Cygnus. If I add up all of the missions per year to the International Space Station that brings up cargo, not human beings now, just cargo, what's your rough guess, Paul, as to the total number of launches per year bringing cargo to the International Space Station? And since you know roughly the number of pounds that each one brings, we could make a rough guess as to the total number of pounds of cargo that's brought to the International Space Station per year. The numbers you've given me and the number of launches that I think take place leads me to believe that we're getting in the vicinity of 50,000 pounds of stuff brought to the International Space Station per year. Am I possibly in the right ballpark on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, you're close. I think it was 65,000 pounds of stuff, so roughly 8 or 9 flights per year of cargo. So, you know, sometimes more, sometimes less. That's the average. And this poundage has increased over the years instead of decreased. So, don't forget the space station got bigger. When it got bigger back in 2009, they started flying 6 people instead of 3. Now, that will be changing again this spring. It's going to drop down to 5 people. The Russians don't want to pay for 3 guys up there anymore. They just want to pay for 2. It's getting too expensive. They're not getting as much science down as they used to. They planned on putting another module up, but that's been delayed. If that ever gets up, then they'll go back to 3 people again, and then we'll have 6 on board for a while. That will now change to 7 once Dragon or Boeing gets their Starliner going, because then they'll be able to bring up 4 people per flight instead of 3. So, fun trying to keep all the straight, but that's why, you know, I don't even tell you all the launches. Let me drop it. That go on, and it's probably a bit unfair. Somebody might be interested in a certain type of launch that I just don't cover. To give you an idea, we have we already started December. There's 15 more worldwide launches that are going to be going up before the end of the year, you know, for this month. So I can't cover them all. And then there's other suborbital launches. There's that one by Richard Branson. He's doing that suborbital vehicle that's going to carry a 6 passengers. He's working to develop that. Now, just the other day, a couple of days ago, he flew that. He did a drop test off the White Knight 2 and successfully landed that. No rocket power right now. He's just he'll do a couple more of those. Before you know, we'll be talking about that thing eventually going up to the Kármán line and someday bring him people. But he had two people on board just to test the landing and two pilots on board. And that worked out okay. It's now called Unity. The first one that crashed, it blew up. It didn't blow up, it completely crashed. 2 years ago, that was Enterprise. That didn't work out too good. Unfortunately killed one guy. But so far, this one's doing good. There's so many things to talk about. Blue Origin with their crewed capsule, and there's no end to it. Back to you, Dick, WS1.
I'm still a little bit surprised at 65,000 pounds of stuff on average per year brought to the International Space Station. Most of that is maintaining the astronauts. This is not brand new modules. This is not not a whole lot of that is brand new hardware, you know, test equipment or whatever. I'm guessing the majority of that is fuel, food, water, clothing, spacesuit replaceable modules. Is that approximately what most of the 65,000 pounds is, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
They bring up fuel, they bring up, there was some oxygen, I think 100 pounds of oxygen on this last one that blew up. They always bring a little extra of this, even so they keep recycling it. I know they've had some problems with their oxygen resupply unit, so there were some parts on there that they were going to replace, I guess, before it broke down. So I'm sure they'll, you know, load them, you know, probably fly it real quick to Japan before Friday. And there's always some last minute stuff that they allow to get on these spacecraft, and I'm, you know, before they go up, they'll probably do that. And by the way, Dick, one of the most successful rockets that have been going up, the Atlas V. I didn't get the app yet. You got an app where you could theoretically build your own rocket until you had a certain amount of weight that you want to launch to the space station or somewhere, or maybe the geosynchronous orbit. You can plug these numbers into this app. Let me drop it.
I have a question for Paul when you have a chance.
Oh, okay, John. And you can plug the numbers into this app, and they'll tell you, you know, what size rocket you need, what kind of boosters you need. By the way, I sent the nomenclature picture, you know, numbers that they use for Atlas, for the Atlas rocket over here. Dick, I don't know if you saw that. I copied a picture of what it looks like in the bottom view, all the different ones. And the Atlas is the easiest one to remember to get into the Delta IIs and all the other different rockets. It gets a little bit more confusing. But Atlas has a pretty good system. I don't know if you saw that. You know, we talked about the 401s and the 411s and all that. That breaks it down on what's what when they go up. Back to you, Dick, and I, you know, John wants to say something.
Yeah, when I get a chance, I'm going to come back to the 100 pounds of oxygen, which scares me a little bit. But go ahead first, John. KC2WGB, you got it.
Yeah, quick question for you guys. Paul, in all of your reading, and you also, Dick, pound for pound, what has more thrust, the solid rockets or the liquid? Maybe you guys have some info on that. I was always curious.
Oh, the solid. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, each SRB is 2.5 million pounds. Isn't that true, John? The SRBs that we used on the space shuttle. I think they're 2.5 million pounds apiece. However, they're really big and heavy. So when it comes to, his real question is pound for pound. Well, you got to be careful now. In the case of a solid rocket booster, you're measuring the weight of the rocket plus all of its solid fuel. In the case of a liquid rocket, which gives more bang for the, which gives more thrust per pound, do you think, John? I mean, Paul, WS2N, K2IW?
think of it this way. The space line system that's going to be going up has four, really, they're space shuttle engines. So they're going to have four space shuttle engines instead of three. And each one is a little over 500,000 pounds. So we'll call it 500,000 pounds. So that gives you a 2 million pound thrust there. So on four engines. Now you have only two solid booster rockets attached to this new SLS space launch system. But they're monsters. I mean, they are big. I think each one is 120, 130 feet tall, something like that. And each one of those will give you 3.5 million pounds of thrust. So that's, you add those together, you got 7 million pounds of thrust for two rocket engines compared to the four rocket engines, the liquid engines on the liquid hydrogen engines on the core stage. You know, you got four engines really only giving you 2 million pounds of thrust. So now the difference is, look at the size of the tank, the fuel tank for the liquid hydrogen. So after 2 minutes, the solids are going to drop off, similar to what you used to see with the space shuttle, and the liquid tank will keep firing these four shuttle engines, you know, for the next 8 minutes, next 6.5 minutes before that cuts off. They call that MECO, main engine cutoff. That gives you an idea of, you know, about weight. I don't know. Without doubt, I'd say the thrust on the
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
I'm going to go back for a minute on the 100 pounds of oxygen that were brought up. Is that the content of oxygen inside of the container, or is the container plus oxygen 100 pounds? In either case, it's not a huge amount. A human being draws about a liter of air on each individual breath. And if you're in the resting state, you breathe something like 20 breaths per minute. And 60 minutes per hour and 24 hours a day, you put it all together, 24,000 liters of air flows through your body per day. 24,000 liters is 2.5 cubic meters, and a certain percentage of that is oxygen. So what I'm getting at is that I think a man burns up in the vicinity of 5 pounds of oxygen per day. I may be a little high on that. So 100 pounds of oxygen, 5 pounds per day per man, is 20 man days. So 100 pounds of oxygen is 20 man days, and you get 5 or 6 astronauts on board. So as I see it, you're going to burn through that reasonably fast. I presume the majority of the oxygen is coming from the electrolysis process, water being separated into oxygen and hydrogen. Or, I was about to say recycling. I don't think oxygen gets recycled, although maybe it does. The carbon dioxide, is that getting recycled? So where's the majority of the oxygen coming from that's sustaining 5 or 6 astronauts, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Don't they have oxygen scrubbers?
CO2 scrubbers.
And then it's 98% or 99% of the carbon dioxide. All the oxygen gets recycled. It comes back. Not all, but, you know, like 99%. So they only have to make up a little bit here and there. And when, you know, the American side goes up, they usually bring up bigger tanks. I've seen them. I don't know what they weigh, though. They're bigger tanks. A lot of it's lost during the EVAs. They lose it that way. I don't know. 100 pounds here, 100 pounds there. doesn't sound like much, but when they're recycling like 99% of the stuff, it's good. You don't need that much. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, the human being is taking in nitrogen and oxygen. I think the International Space Station is running at 14 pounds per square inch, 14.7. You're going to correct me on that one, Paul. I think it's running at full air pressure. And so the human being is breathing out carbon dioxide. And I think you're telling me the instrumentation, the equipment on board, recycles all of the carbon dioxide and recaptures all of the oxygen. And what does it do with the carbon? That's a minor detail. So the carbon dioxide, the oxygen is recovered. How many of those carbon dioxide recovery machines do they have? Is there a backup if one of those fails? How reliable are they? Tell me about those carbon dioxide recycling machines. What's it called? How many? How reliable? How long have they been there? Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
They brought it up before this shuttle stopped in 2011, so let's call it 6 or 7 years. And they had a lot of problems in the beginning. Different valves didn't work. They worked all of that out. I don't know if they have a backup, but, you know, an identical unit like that. I don't even know if this is the second version, you know, of what they started out with. Might be. I know where it's located. It's located in the Harmony node. I can tell you where the Harmony node is too, but that's one of the last modules that they bought up. Not the last, but one of them. In fact, if you see any pictures of these guys looking out the window, they're looking out the cupola, these six trapezoid-looking windows, and then one round one over the top of that. That cupola is, those windows are attached to one of the ports on the Harmony module. Inside the Harmony module, they also have this massive recycling machine, oxygen regeneration machine, I think they call it. So, you're right, 14.7 pounds, and they have nitrogen up there as well. So, and they have big nitrogen tanks.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Less modules where they do all the EVAs, and I'm going to sign them out right now. Back to you, Chris.
Okay. These, I get the impression that in that module you've got one single carbon dioxide converter that gives you oxygen back. Each human being, by his metabolism, is generating 130 watts of heat on average 24/7. An awful lot of that is because of his metabolism of burning oxygen with his food. So, if the machine worked at 100% efficiency to convert one man's worth of carbon dioxide back into oxygen, it might be in the vicinity of 130 watts. 5 or 6 astronauts, 780 watts per hour, 24 hours, we're talking about 16,000 watt hours of oxygen metabolism is going on with those 6 astronauts. Guarantee that machine is not running at 100% efficiency in the way it recaptures that oxygen. The human being developed its heat by oxidizing that oxygen into carbon dioxide. You have to put at least that amount of energy back in to recover that oxygen from that carbon. So the sheer energy consumption of this machine, if it runs at 100% efficiency, there's a lot of kilowatts going into that machine to run it. And I know that they've got these. Let me drop them. For temporary purposes, I think good for half a day or something like that, you've got this oxygen mask-like device that runs a chemical reaction that gives you oxygen in an emergency situation. I think they had to use those on the Soviet space station on one occasion. So, sounds like the majority of the oxygen is coming from carbon dioxide recovery, and a lot of power is going into that machine, in my opinion, unless I've made a couple of decimal places error here, John. And it sounds like it's the main source of their oxygen. Like, if that machine fails, you've got some bottles of oxygen, and you've got these masks, and after that, I guess you climb into the Soyuz and come back home. WS2N, K2IW.
I remember I had problems at the beginning. It used to fail, so they used to use the electrolysis machine. Let me drop it. They had at least three at the time, and that was years ago. Big electrolysis machines. They look like big, tall, thin garbage cans. They would produce oxygen. So they were, that was electrolysis. And I think to some degree they still use it with converting the water. And I'm not sure about the chemistry. I'll have to review the chemistry again on how the CO2 gets converted. Somehow I think water gets converted back. Oh, I know what it is. I know what it is. All the moisture and water in the inside the space station all gets, any vapor. It's also saved, and they turn that back into water. That's what it is. And now they have a lot, plenty of extra water, because like 90% of that stuff gets reused too. So plenty of extra water, and now you have all this water, and then they'll do the electrolysis if need be. And I guess that makes up some of the 2 or 3%, whatever they're not recycling. Now it's starting to come back to me. So now these big electrolysis machines could add oxygen, and then they just dump the hydrogen overboard. And then as an emergency, they have these candles. The Russians supply them, oxygen candles, and they ignite them somehow. Because of this burning process, it releases oxygen. They don't last all that long, but it's a real good backup. They use it on the mirror, like you said. They might have used it on the space station early on.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Problem that they had, but I know they work. Let me drop it. And one of them did go on fire on the mirror. Had some kind of a fire. I think one of those things caused that problem. So I'm not too crazy about those things. But that's where you're at pretty much with the recycling. On the space station. Now you got to be able to do all this for years on end without any resupplies. You need it almost 100% to get this thing all the way to Mars. I think they better work on this a little bit more. I think they need a little bit more reliability before they light off those engines to ion engines or whatever they use to get the Mars thing. I think they need to have this down pat. Back to you.
Are they using the electrolysis machine now to convert water into oxygen and hydrogen and dump the hydrogen overboard? Are they using that in parallel with the carbon dioxide recovery machine? Or, for some reason, have they stopped using the electrolysis machine? And by the way, the total kilowatts of power required to run it to separate oxygen and hydrogen. You know that when you put oxygen and hydrogen in a test tube and you light it off, you get quite a bang. You get a lot of energy out of it. Well, to separate them, you have to put that amount of energy back. So it looks to me like the watts required to run the electrolysis machine and the watts to run the CO2 machine could be very similar. Are they using both of those in parallel, or have they stopped using the electrolysis machine? If so, why? Over to you, Paul, K2IW.
I think they'll put it on whenever they need it, there is, I think, 1 or 2% that's not being recycled, so that always has to be made up, and whether or not they take that from the spare tanks or from the electrolysis, I think it's 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other, or maybe both. So, I don't know. Yeah, electricity-wise, they got plenty of electricity. Don't forget, they got enough power to run 40 homes here on Earth from all those solar panels. What they are worried about is the batteries. You know, these batteries, they're nickel metal hydride batteries, and they're huge. They're all over on the outside of the spaceship. They have 11 truss sections all put together. And out near where every photovoltaic cell comes down, they have a station of large batteries. I mean, each one weighs hundreds of pounds. And there was probably 80 of them all over the space station. And they're scheduled to be replaced. Now, they were supposed to be replaced 6 months ago when we dropped. In fact, one of the astronauts, Kate Rubin, she was trained to do one of the EVAs to start switching out these batteries that were going to be sent up. But they were supposed to come up in that Japan HTV... cargo ship that we talked about earlier in that, and they were going to start replacing these things. They had the external robot floating around on the space station. He's already loosened a lot of the bolts, and this way it's going to cut back on the EVA time. It's going to take probably 2-3 EVAs over many, many months to replace these batteries. They're replacing them with lithium ion batteries, so they've reached the end of their life term. You know, it's been up there, 15 years, so it's time for new batteries, and they're going to put these new, better batteries in, you know, lithium ion. Back to you, Dick.
I'm guessing the batteries are required. Every orbit is 90 minutes. Roughly 45 of those minutes, you're behind the Earth in darkness, so you're using those batteries every 45 minutes. And your solar cells can turn out 80 or 100 kilowatts, numbers like that, 120 kilowatts, I think you gave me at one time as a number. And so a good percentage of those kilowatts have to come out of those batteries when you're in the darkness. By the way, I'm guessing right now that they run the CO2 machine most of the time, because carbon dioxide is a true waste product, whereas the electrolysis machine takes potable water and converts it into liquid oxygen and hydrogen. So now you're using up the water the astronauts could use as a consumable. Therefore, you're going to use a lot less of that, as I see it. Therefore, I can see how the CO2 converter is the major source of oxygen. And so the CO2 converter is taking the O2 and leaving the C, the carbon. Any idea what happens to that carbon? Does it just pile up somewhere and get thrown away? OU Pulse, WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, it becomes a solid, probably in some kind of strainer or something in the system. I've never seen a close-up on it, of course, but I do know it becomes like a solid. And over time, I don't know how much time we're talking about, years or decades, I don't know, over time you need to... remove this, so you could only do it one or two ways. Either take the strainer. It's supposed to really be very hard to get off, you know, to brush it off or whatever. My guess is that they probably toss it. Maybe they put it into one of the, the cargo ships that are going to burn up, maybe into a Cygnus cargo craft and let it burn up into the Pacific. And maybe, as the new cargo vehicles come up, maybe they put new ones in. Maybe, there was supposed to be some replacement parts for this oxygen recycling machine on that one that blew up, that Progress ship. So maybe that was part of it. I don't know exactly what parts. I did bring up the manifest of everything that was on there. And they didn't break it down into that finer detail. They just said, replacement parts for the oxygen regeneration machine, whatever it's called. They don't go into that kind of detail on the website. Back to you, Dick.
I'm getting the impression, Paul, that the carbon dioxide converter machine gives you the oxygen back out, and the carbon builds up in there on some kind of a filter, screen, or whatever. And periodically you have to turn the machine off and either clean or replace that filter. So therefore,